231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice of board meetings in writing, please email Monica at kbu.org.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
The World Arts Foundation Incorporated and KBOO would like to invite you to its 32nd annual tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on Monday, January the 16th from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center located at 7600 Northeast Gleason. Invited guests will include a multitude of speakers and performances that includes the Portland Interfaith Gospel Choir and choirs from the Portland Public Schools, African drumming, and the acclaimed Jefferson Dancers, and much, much more. Monday, January the 16th, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., live right here on KBOO 90.7 FM. Keep alive the dream.
The greatness of America is the right to protest far rights.
I was leaving the South to fling myself into the unknown. I was taking a part of the South to transplant in alien soil, to see if it could grow differently, if it could drink of new and cool rains, bend in strange winds, respond to the warmth of other suns, and perhaps to bloom.
Good morning and welcome to Black Book Talk. That was Isabel Wilkerson, the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration. Good morning, Isabel, and welcome to Black Book Talks. I'm Patricia Welch, library lady.
O.B. Hill, community historian.
And we just want to thank you for this book. I know that O.B. and I have both, you know, now that we've read the book, we understand our families are where they are because of this great and unrecognized for the movement that it was, this great migration. So why did you decide to write this book?
Well, it was my family story. So in many ways, I grew up with the surrounded by people who were part of the great migration and not realizing it. I was surrounded in Washington, D.C. by people who were from my parents were from the South. My mother from Rome, Georgia. My father from Southern Virginia. They had both migrated to Washington D.C., where they met, married, and where I was born. And I was surrounded by people who were from Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and it was everywhere: the food, the music, the language, the accents, everything. And it was so obvious and so real that I think we took it for granted. And once I became a journalist and began traveling over the country and for the New York Times, where I was bureau chief in Chicago for many years, and I had the chance to travel over the country and realize it was not just my experience growing up in Washington, D.C., or the people who were in Chicago whose parents or grandparents had come from Mississippi and Arkansas, but that people in Los Angeles, people on the entire West Coast, everywhere that was not South, was affected by the Great Migration. And so this was a national story that involved the majority of African Americans that you might ever meet in the North, the Midwest, and the West. So it was huge. And I decided that I wanted to set out to try to tell this story through the lives of three people who were participants in this Great Migration.
You say that it's the story of your life, your forebears. So is the words that we're hearing, is the conversations, that kind of thing, are those ones that were related to you by the grandchildren of those people?
Well, it's interesting. When I say that I was surrounded by it, I was surrounded by the culture of the Great Migration, but not the stories of the Great Migration. In other words, people didn't often talk about their experiences.
Okay.
And I found that I wanted to hear more about the stories in order to put it in context and to make it real for those of us who didn't participate in it, and to give honor in some ways to those who had.
What years exactly do you cover in this analysis?
The Great Migration began in around 1915 during World War One, and it began in part because the people were living under a caste system, which is hard for us to imagine now, They were, in some ways, this Great Migration was a defection from the Jim Crow South, in which the actions and the work life and private life of African Americans in the South were regulated by arcane rules that determined that in Birmingham, for example, black people and white people could not play checkers together, that there was that kind of, that anything that could be devised to keep the races apart was implemented. And so they were living under an incredible caste system. And that migration began during World War One and did not end until the 1970s, when the initial reasons for this need to leave the caste system essentially came to an end with the civil rights movement. And so you had no longer the need for so many people to leave. But that was, you're talking about three generations of people who did participate in this Great Migration. We're talking about 6 million people who left the South between World War I, 1915, and the 1970s. So you're talking a huge number of people. One statistic that is stunning, that puts it in perspective, is the fact that African Americans, 90% of them were living in the South before the migration began. And at the end of it, nearly half were living outside of the South. So if this was a complete, in some ways it was a redistribution of the black population, and it was in some ways a defection, seeking of political asylum in some ways from the South.
And yet from what you've written, and also what I've heard from others, because my family came up the southern route, where we ended up in Maryland and came from North and South Carolina. But even though there were many good reasons for people to leave the South, and I hope that you'll cite some of them, and yet I know there was still that longing to return. I heard my grandmother say in her later years, I still want to go back home. I don't want to die up here. Can you kind of talk about that dichotomy of, on the one hand, really needing to get away, and yet somehow longing to stay, that how difficult it was for people to leave?
You know, one of the things that I spent so much time thinking about and researching was, and talking to, you know, I interviewed over 1,200 people for this book. And what I heard over and over again was this kind of yearning for a place to be the best that they could be. There was this desire, there was such a difficult decision that the people had to make, a heartbreaking decision that they had to make, to leave the only place that they had ever known for a place that they had never seen. There were no guarantees of success, and they were going to be far, far away from their, you know, their parents, their family, the land that they had known. It was an incredibly difficult decision that they had to make, which is why it's such a defining moment in African American history and in American history, because these people in some ways were forced to make a decision that usually immigrants have to make, and yet they made the decision within their own country. So that many people felt in some ways like exiles, to get to your point about the heartbreak and the longing and the feeling of homesickness that many of the people had to live with. One of the things that they would often do to try to overcome that is they surrounded themselves with other people like themselves. They often would, the churches would often be, in some ways, replicas of the experiences and the congregations and the flocks that they had, that they experienced back home. There were often clubs that would be created in these northern and western cities. There was, for example, in Los Angeles, there's a Monroe, Louisiana club. There's a Lake Charles, Louisiana club in Chicago. There are many Mississippi and Arkansas clubs. So then in some ways, people tried to recreate what they had back home. Many people, for example, in my own case, my mother constantly was trying to plant azaleas and hydrangeas that did not quite grow as well in Washington, D.C. as they had in Georgia. So there was this homesickness for it. And in fact, one of the people that I came across in the course of writing the book was a quote that kind of haunts me, from a man who ended up in Pittsburgh from Alabama. And he said, if I had any choice, I would have rather stayed home.
Yes.
I would rather have stayed there. But he felt he had no other choice, so he left. So it was a heartbreaking decision that almost every African-American of that era had to make, and many of them made it not wanting to leave home. They would rather have stayed home.
You know, we should mention something because you've probably heard a third voice, and we want to welcome Emma Jackson Ford, our third member, who has joined our conversation. Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning. Emma, would you like to take the next question?
I was going to make a comment. One of the things I really liked about the book was that you started it with a quote from either a newspaper or the Bible or some writer. That kind of set the tone for it, and I really like that. It lent a good feeling to the book.
Thank you so much for noting that, because that was something that was very important to me. I wanted to be able to show rather than tell that this was a massive experience that you could see in all literature, in music, and in even the Bible itself. And it, to me, there was a great deal of work that went into finding the right quote or passage from the Bible to represent this particular part of the book. And so you will see quoted in the book, there are excerpts from Ralph Ellison, from James Baldwin, from Richard Wright, which is what I read at the top of the of our conversation here. And so I wanted people to be able to see the relevance in, it's almost as if all of these were part of a Greek chorus, which were supporting the larger goal. And to show how widespread this was, August Wilson is quoted in the book, Toni Morrison is quoted in the book, Langston Hughes is quoted in the book. And so all of these voices, and of course, Exodus is quoted in the book, Deuteronomy, because it is so much like the Exodus of the original Exodus in the Bible, where people felt that they had to go, great waves of people leaving reluctantly in many cases and never looking back because they could not look back. So I really appreciate your saying that. Some people like to just read those, you know, just to sort of be able to, it's almost as if you have an anthology, so to speak, of the migration and just those quotes alone. Not to mention, of course, getting to the protagonists, the characters in the book, the very real people, the three people, Ida Mae Gladney, George Swanson Starling, and Dr. Robert Foster, each of whom represent the three main streams of this migration. The stream that went up the East Coast from Georgia, the Carolinas, and Virginia up to Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, and New York. And that's represented by a man named George Starling, who was a college student who was reduced to becoming a fruit picker and had to flee for his life because he had tried to organize the pickers to get better work conditions, and he had to flee to New York from Florida in 1945. And then the second stream was from Mississippi and Arkansas and parts of Alabama and Tennessee up to Chicago, to Detroit, Cleveland, and the entire Midwest. And that's represented by Ida Mae Gladney, who was a sharecropper's wife, who was terrible at picking cotton, just terrible at picking cotton. And she and her family ended up having to leave under cover of night, because a relative had been beaten to within 1 inch of his life for over a theft that he did not commit. The thing that they thought he had stolen turned up the next day. And so she had to leave, and they left in 1937. And then the final route, the final migration stream, which gets us to the West Coast, is that of people who left often Louisiana and Texas for the entire West Coast, from Los Angeles all the way up to Seattle. And that's the lesser discussed part of the migration, and that's represented by Dr. Robert Foster, who left Louisiana for Los Angeles and had a perilous journey, far more perilous than he anticipated, because it turned out that he could not find a motel that would give him a room for the night through much of the journey that he had to make. And I tried to recreate that journey myself years later.
You're listening to Black Book Talk on KBOO. Listen, you interviewed over 1,200 people, and this book is actually about 116 pages, including the epilogue, acknowledgments, etc.
Not 100. You said 116. I'm sure you didn't mean that. You meant like 7.
You wouldn't even have met Dr. Foster if you went that far.
No, it read like 116 pages, but
excuse me, 716 pages.
But it did read like.
Excuse me, 716 pages of interviews, and then you break it down into different individuals that you acknowledge there, and you wrote them. How did you select who would be in this book out of all of those people?
Yes, I interviewed, I stopped counting actually after 1200 because it was, I was talking to so many people in senior centers and in AARP meetings at high school reunions. And I went to Baptist churches in New York where everybody was from South Carolina. I went to the various clubs, the state clubs that I described to you that exist in so many of the cities that are beautiful representation of the fact that the culture, the Southern culture, survives even to this day, no matter how far flung it may appear. But I needed to settle on three people who would represent these three streams that I described to you before. And I wanted the three people to be different from one another so that when you opened up the book and you turned to a page, you can say, oh, yes, this is Ina May. Or you could turn to another page and say, oh, yes, this has got to be George. And you turn to another one and you say, oh, yes, this is Dr. Foster for sure. So I wanted them to be distinctive people. I also needed people who would represent the different decades of the migration. So each one of them left during a different era. Ida May left first. She left in 1937 during the Depression. George Starling left from Florida to New York in 1945 during World War II. So you get a sense of how it was different for him. The experiences he had were different because of the time that he left. And then Dr. Foster left last. He left in 1953. And that's reflective of the fact that the migration to the West Coast was a later migration. So that needed to be shown too. But I also just wanted to have great characters, great people that you could identify with and fall in love with as I had, and you could see yourself or your parents or your grandparents in, and that's who they reflect too. So each of them is different. George Starling he's defiant and he's proud and dignified, and he was not willing to accept the world that he was in, the caste system that he was in, and he kind of chafed against it. Ida May Gladney was a very spiritual and person and loving person who everyone just fell in love with and who was an inspiration to people, who had a way of looking at the world and accepting what was and not trying to, you know, she really lived the Serenity Prayer. She was funny. All of them were actually funny. I had great senses of humor. And then Dr. Foster was a man who had a proud bearing, was always very ambitious, but he was a big gambler. And he had his ups and downs, but always seemed to rise the top. He actually became the personal physician to Ray Charles. And there's actually a song written about him that came out in the early 1960s called Hide Nor Hair, in which Ray Charles talks about his doctor, Robert Foster. He's named in the song. Yes. So these are characters in unto themselves. Each one of them could have been a book unto themselves. They were just beautiful people. And I chose them out of the 1,200 because they made a nice combination so that the three become one. The three give you all the different aspects of the Great Migration as it unfolded.
For those who are joining us, I just want to remind that we are talking, to Isabel Wilkerson, the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration. You know, I also want our listeners to know that you are currently the professor of journalism and the director of the narrative nonfiction program at Boston University. And that in 1994, you won the Pulitzer Prize while at the New York Times Pulitzer Prize in journalism while you were at the New York Times. I was absolutely not at all surprised when I read that, because as I mentioned to you when we talked a little earlier, as a person who loves reading fiction, I was crazy about this great big 700-page nonfiction book. You write so beautifully and so compellingly and so poetically about a topic that in many cases can be very difficult. You know, when you really, really show why people left, it can be very difficult. But you read beautifully. And with Dr. Foster, honest to goodness, by the time he got to, it was San Diego that he went to first, right?
Yes, he landed in San Diego first.
I was so tired. And when it started, I wasn't really fond of Dr. Foster. I didn't think you were either because of some of the things you were saying about him. But as time went on, I was like, oh my gosh, that is my Uncle Sylvester who left Baltimore to go to California because he was an architect and a wonderful architect, but was not going to get his due in Baltimore, and took his wife and went out for this brave new world. So you wrote so beautifully, but how long did it take you to write this book?
It took me 15 years. I gave up 15 years of my life for this book. It was just that important to me. And these people were just that beautiful. I absolutely, it's interesting. I've been asked if I have a favorite. People make, you know, look at it and try to say, oh, she likes this one better, she likes this one better. I love them all because they all, the story is not complete without one of the three. You must see that it was a national outpouring of people. And you must see that it was across class. You had doctors, you have sharecroppers, you have people who worked the railroad, you had teachers, you had all kinds of musicians, all kinds of people. It was so big, it's hard to put your hand, get your hands around all of it. And yet through these three people, you get to see the breadth and the scope of it. And that's what I wanted to do. And I wanted people to be able to fall in love with these people and to be pulling for them. A lot of people say as they read the book that they're worried about them. They're worried whether he's going to make it across the desert.
Yes.
You know, and I think it's an interesting thing. You don't think of people reading a book, a nonfiction book, and being worried for the characters. And yet that's what people say.
Because they were so real.
Well, it shows.
They were so real.
It shows that you put a lot of work into it. This book could be used as a textbook. You even have an index and a methodology section. This is wonderful.
And
well, it was also important that people realize that there's several things. One is there's a lot in the book that people do not know because I was discovering things I had no idea. Even though I had been raised by people who were part of the Great Migration, there are so many things I did not know. And so people might think they know a lot about the Great Migration, but I can guarantee you, you have no idea until you get a chance to really go deep into this huge epic. You know, there's so much that was written about the Dust Bowl migration out to the West Coast from during the 1930s, or the Gold Rush migration. This migration dwarfed all those others by many, many millions. There's no comparison to these others, and yet we don't know that much about it. We think we do, but we don't. And so there was so much in it, but it was really important to me that people not pick this up as a dry history book. It is not.
Oh, no, it's not.
It is the opposite of that. People are pulled into this book. People are pulled into these characters. These people were so candid and honest with you. They would say there were many, many mistakes that they made in their life, and they were upfront about the mistakes that they had made. None of the people are perfect, nor do they present themselves as perfect. There are so many lessons even from their lives when it comes to the decisions that they made as adults. The decision, for example, of George Starling and his marriage, for example. You know, how he even chose the decision. You know, there's so many things you can learn beyond that. It's like sitting at your grandparents' knee and hearing all that they had to say to you that you may not have caught when you were little, but now you can get it. And that's what the beauty of all this is. But the goal was that people get pulled into the story so that you almost imagine yourself as saying, what would I have done? What would I have done if I had been living in a caste system as they were in the South? Would I have stayed or would I have left? What would I have done if I was faced with living in a big anonymous city where people didn't, it turned out, did not even want people like me there? What would I have done? Would I have gone back home and then had the people say, oh, I knew she couldn't make it. I just knew they weren't going to make it. You know, I wanted people to understand that sort of immigrant heart, the heart of a person who has to make a decision like that and to make it real for people so that they would feel themselves in it. And then also it was vital that people know the impact of this migration. It's the children that were really the beneficiaries of this migration, not so much the people who actually left. Those children include people such as Michelle Obama, Toni Morrison, August Wilson, the playwright. They include the founder of Motown, Berry Gordy. There would be no Motown if there were no Great Migration because his parents migrated from Georgia to Detroit, where he had the chance to grow up. When he became a grown man, he wanted to go into music. He didn't have the money to go going all over the country scouting out the best talent. He looked right around him, and there were children of the Great Migration. There was Diana Ross, whose parents had migrated from Alabama and from West Virginia to Detroit. And there were the Temptations, who had actually come up from Alabama. I mean, the migration itself there's so many after effects of the Great Migration that we're still trying to understand it. Jazz simply would not be what it is now had there been no great migration. Miles Davis's parents migrated from Arkansas to Illinois, where he had the chance to learn music in a way he wouldn't have otherwise. Thelonious Monk, his parents migrated when he was 5 years old from North Carolina to Harlem. And then John Coltrane migrated himself when he was 17 from North Carolina to Philadelphia, where, believe it or not, he got his first alto sax. Where would jazz be? Where would music be? Where would our culture be if John Coltrane had not gotten hold of an alto sax?
Mention also Bill Russell, story of his family.
Bill Russell, his parents were in Monroe, Louisiana, where Dr. Robert Foster was from. We just mentioned Dr. Robert Foster. His parents were there. They had a very difficult time in Monroe, Louisiana, during the Jim Crow South years, during that caste system. At one point, Bill Russell's mother was walking down the street in one of her favorite outfits, her Sunday clothes, and a police officer came up to her and told her to take them off. Don't ever let him see her in those clothes again, because what she had on was not fit for a colored woman to wear, that those were the clothes that only a white woman should wear. And she had to go home immediately because she could be arrested if she was seen in those clothes again. Bill Russell was a little boy, and he came home from school and saw his mother crying at the kitchen table because they had been through so much involving life and death. And they decided to set out for Oakland. And they did when he was 9 years old, and they made it to Oakland, and there he had the opportunity to go to integrated schools, which so many of the children of the Great Migration had the opportunity to do, such as myself. He had the opportunity to go to the University of San Francisco, where he led the Dons to two NCAA championships, when he would never have been able to even go to a school that had an NCAA team, because the schools in Louisiana and in all of the South were segregated. And then he went on, of course, to go to join the Celtics, where he led the Celtics to 11 championships in the time that he was there. He became one of the greatest NBA players ever to play the game. Where would sports be had his parents not migrated? That's the import. That's just one window into the effects of the Great Migration.
I have about a gazillion questions, but a comment. Throughout the book, there were the constant references, so to me, comparisons to similarities between European migrants and the migrants in this country who you're focusing on. And I had never really thought about that, but many of the pains are the same. They're universal. I think that people who are listening, whose parents' old country was the old country, you know, across an ocean, could certainly identify with this. But I don't know if there's something that you'd like to say about that. We have about, I'd say like a minute left.
It's my goal to show, I mean, it really is so important to me, because I had the opportunity to go to school with some of the people who had come from far away, come across the ocean, because I had the chance to go to an integrated school. And I often noted that they would tell the stories about what their great-grandparents had done, their grandparents had done, what they had sacrificed, and how they had come to be. And I often didn't feel as if I had any stories to tell. And I didn't realize that we actually do have stories to tell, and we actually have so much more in common than we've been led to believe. Everybody, most of the people in this, on this land, the United States, come from someplace else. And of course, African Americans came from far away during the Middle Passage. But once we got to this country, the majority of us also came from, made another migration, and that was from the South. And so we have so much in common with other people. And the goal would be that we would all stop and find the oldest person in our families, regardless of where we came from, whether from across the Atlantic, across the Pacific, across the Rio Grande, or from Georgia to New York, or from Louisiana to the West Coast, wherever we came from, to find those people and get the stories before it's too late.
Oh, thank you for joining us. Thank you for sharing this universal story. We do hope that everyone will take the opportunity to read The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. Isabel Wilkerson, thank you for joining us. And, you know, I feel like this is only half of the interview. Please come back and join us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you're tuned to Community Radio KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and the Willamette Valley. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW.